Hey, thanks for dropping by. Come on in.
Time to retire to the drawing room.
Tonight in the drawing room, we'll explore whatever connections we might find between feral neighbours from hell and testicular cancer. That is our challenge. Our medium for this little exchange, two new Australian movies that open in cinemas tonight. The King is Dead by writer-director Rolf de Heer and Not Suitable for Children, written by Michael Lucas. Now, you might know Rolf from various projects, Bad Boy Bubby, Ten Canoes perhaps, and you'll have seen Michael's name in a range of credits, TV's runaway success Offspring among them. And both of us join us in the drawing room tonight. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yes. Good evening, Jonathan.
Now, both these films take, rather different situations and explore their consequences. Rolf, you've given us a pretty effective portrait of a lot of worst suburban nightmares here. It all goes a bit sort of Breaking Bad. Is this drawn from your own particular anxieties of life in the suburbs?
Not so much anxieties as look, there are elements that I've experienced. There are elements I've heard about, and there are elements of complete fiction, and it's all melded together to create the one.
We have a couple that move in, and what they find is perhaps not what they might have expected. And
no, they're pretty unsuspecting when they move in.
Resolves awkwardly, you might say.
Yes. Look, I wrote at a time when I needed to be light, and I had this subject matter come to me. And
What's the process there? Because you say at a time when you needed to be light. I mean, this is your work is a stack of contrasts.
Yes, it is. I had just done a screenplay that had taken a year or so, and it was a work of commission. It was not for me to direct, and was about as deep and darkly into the human condition as you can go. And it was parts that were very difficult to deal with. Mm. Then I had the opportunity to keep writing, which I like doing. And I've just felt I wanted to be light, you know, after that experience, in a sense. It was a great experience, but it was a heavy experience.
Is being light also being liked? Is there a connection between the two, do you think?
Not for me, no. Being liked, well, look, you know, I want to be liked by my Molly, that's about it, really, and my daughters, and that's about all that's really important. And so I don't do anything in terms of writing just for it to be liked.
Work goes out there, it stands on its own, and the pieces fall where they may. Michael, now, Not Suitable for Children, it takes a really interesting premise of a chap with not very long to give.
Mm. Yeah, so a ticking clock on his fertility.
Very nicely put. It struck me, there was some commentary written about it too, which made this point as well. This is an Australian film, and it's perhaps the hallmark of its Australianness is the delicacy with which it deals with that subject matter. If this had been made in, say, a big US studio, there's a lot of sort of American Pie potential here that you kind of shy away from.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, at certain points we were considering whether or
not going the pie.
Well, no, whether it should actually be a US production. Okay. I mean, it's so difficult to get things financed. And so we had a lot of US reactions to the script. And in most cases, yeah, they were definitely pushing for it to go down that very strong slapstick, Juice Bigelow, male gigolo kind of route, or at the very least something about Mary. And yeah, it was definitely our instinct to pull back from that and to try and keep it a lot more truthful.
Is that a thing about doing things here which, I mean, allows more of that sort of writerly intent to be transferred to the final product? It's a control thing, perhaps?
Yeah, possibly. But I also think that we are much more comfortable sort of sitting in the undefined space between comedy and tragedy. I sort of found that American reactions to the script wanted it more clearly defined. In fact, in many cases, was suggesting completely jettisoning the testicular cancer aspect of the story. And with every beat,
Favour of what?
I'm not making this up, in favour of some sort of wish or curse or something like that that would provoke the same situation.
Bit of magical realism.
Yeah, like Liar Liar or something that, you know, someone puts a curse on him or something.
Because in order to talk about testicular cancer, one must, perforce, speak of testicles, which is perhaps an obstacle in the American industry.
Possibly, yeah. But I think as well, just, you know, talking about cancer and then sort of moving into humour about it was disorientating for American readers in a way that it just seemed natural to me. And in fact, I guess it must be an Australian trait that...
That you can tread across that fence.
Yeah, and find that sort of wry perspective.
This is true in King is Dead too, isn't it, Rolf? It has moments of, oh my God, but also there's a gentleness and a whimsy about it as well.
Yes, I sit here and I listen to this conversation. I think, I'm beginning to discover something here. Yes, I don't think The King is Dead in... Okay, it's been suggested to me that it would make a good remake in America. I don't know exactly
what does that mean?
What it means is that, as it is, there's something about it that works for people, but it won't work in America, according to these suggestions. It happened two or three times so far in the film's brief life. And I think they're suggesting that the premise is good and the characters are good and so on, but they would do it differently in America. You know, they would probably play it for laughs much more easily, because I think we've found ourselves doing quite similar things to what you're talking about, Michael, where there are opportunities in the making of really easy laughs, and we didn't take them.
Yes.
In fact, we shot a sequence that was very funny, and then two nights later reshot it, less funny, because it was the wrong sort of humour to be sitting in there, and it was an easy laugh, and a lot of easy laughs in that sequence that are now, they're still funny, people laugh, but it's okay with the rest of the film. Now, I think the Americans are masters at milking the easy laugh and allowing us to somehow forgive it and keep going, because they just go there all the time. Where I would feel uncomfortable doing that, making this film, because it doesn't feel like it has the integrity that it should, you know.
Mm. Is that a reticence to perhaps an Australian sort of, you know, not wanting to grasp that nettle or not wanting to be quite that bold, wanting to hedge our bets?
I think it's in cinema, it's almost the opposite. It's not so much that we have a reticence, it's that the Americans in their, and this is just what I realised, just now, they don't have the luxury that we do of integrity.
Luxury of integrity,
yes,
a wonderful
yes,
thing.
Yes, yes.
Look, you talk there too, perhaps, Michael, you can take this up about the fluidity of the process, about how things... I mean, I imagine as a non-filmmaker that you write a script and then you go and shoot it, but
if
no.
If only it were that simple.
How much is sort of done on the fly? How much do you change when you see things manifest, when it starts to take shape? Does that then direct the way it ought to go?
I think it varies project to project, but certainly I was trying to keep very much alive to what was happening on set and what the actors were giving. I think also because I've worked a lot in TV, where you really respond to the actor's performance and you sort of feed off them. And so I was on set quite a lot, just looking for opportunities or looking for details, and certainly wasn't ever that I was trying to fix something or alter something substantially. It was more that I would get inspired by what actors were doing, and then I'd be really, really keen to try and bring that back into the screenplay and put it on screen.
The difference on TV, especially with something long running, must be really interesting, because actors would be very invested in that role, in that character, and would have, I'd imagine, firm views on
they do
how things might develop.
They do. Well, it feels like you're, in terms of a long-running TV series, it's like you're in a dance with the actor over that character, because you put something on the page and they bring something a little bit more to it, and then there's always another episode to write, so you can feed off what they've given you. And film doesn't give you as much opportunity for that, but still there is. Still, you know, we were lucky to have a 3-week rehearsal period, which is really rare. So I had lots of opportunities to, you know, take what they were putting out there and try and let it flourish into something.
You're in the drawing room with me, Jonathan Green, and we're talking with two writers and one writer-director, two new Australian films, The King is Dead, writer-director Rolf de Heer, and Not Suitable for Children, written by Michael Lucas. Rolf, as the writer-director, that's a time-honoured role, and we're talking about that issue of integrity. Is it an easier proposition when you have that much control of the process?
It's easier, not so much because you have that much control of it, but communicating the writer's intent to the director is instantaneous and perfectly accurate in my case.
It being you.
It being me. That's right. And I'm never in any doubt as to what the writer intended, and I can be completely 100% faithful to the writer's vision insofar as the production will allow that. When I've directed material that other writers have written, it's too painful for me to see, for first of all, to try and work out what their vision is, and then to try and do it, which I do stupidly, because one shouldn't. As a director, you really have to bring your own vision to it from the material that's there. But because I do respect the written word, I try. But, of course, I'm bound to fail, and I'm bound to make the writer at least partly unhappy with what is happening.
When you're inhabiting both roles and your own work, is there ever a sort of sense of internal dialogue? Do the two parts of you divide on certain issues?
They are, for me, one of the same thing. I will say the first half of directing a film is writing it. You know, I write it as a writer, knowing how it should come out, and have a writer who clearly knows something about directing.
Yes.
And so it's very well presented to be done, really, by the time I finish. And so I recognise, for example, that about the worst place for changes in a script is on set while you're working, because that's the stress situation. That's when your judgment is least good. And in those sort of times, I think it might be nice to have a separation, like the fact that you, Michael, could be on set and be removed from it. I think you could keep the perspective, whereas when you're trying to get the shots in before it gets dark, it's a bad time to start to fiddle with the script. And that's the time when people get tempted very much.
Do you think then, given those sorts of pressures, that maybe your work might have suffered from that, the oneness? Are there times when another director might have brought something out of your writing, do you think?
Absolutely. Other directors would bring different things out of my writing.
Whether that's better or worse, who knows?
Whether it's better or worse, who knows? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think for the sorts of films I try and make, and at the budgets I like to make them at, it's an extremely useful thing to do both. And on the whole, it has many more advantages for me than it has disadvantages.
Michael Lucas, your thoughts on that as the writer? What about the relationship with the director?
Well, in this particular case, the director and I are incredibly close in terms of, I mean, I'm godfather to his children. Yes. and was so before he became involved with the process.
And subsequently?
I still am. I haven't, well done. I haven't been struck out. So we worked incredibly collaboratively. I mean, I've given him a story credit on the script. He was so entrenched in it. And it does lead to a lot of long, long, long discussions about the ways that scenes should play and the ways that the story should turn. And that can be quite exhausting, but I guess in our case, we just tried to embrace it. And often we would joke that things would evolve into court cases where we take up our positions and argue our points. And as long as we both went into it and tried to keep our egos in check, I think in most cases, in the end, the winner was the story, because the best option had to be the one that was most strongly justified by the story.
But there must be processes around some films and TV where the story is not honoured, where the story isn't the top of that pantheon, where it's simply a cog in a much bigger and quicker process.
That must be true. And I think particularly, you know, when you're working on projects that are being strongly tailored for a particular market and there's certain things that you have to hit. But, you know, luckily, I think with an independent film of a relatively low budget, it does come down to the story, and we were given a lot of freedom and space and protection as well by the producers to make the choices that we thought were right.
Is there something about writing which is such a, I mean, it strikes me as being such an individualistic, a solitary in your head process, that its translation to something as sort of open, discursive and collaborative as filmmaking is sort of intrinsically tough?
I think so. I think that's probably why screenwriting's a tough gig, because writing is inherently solitary and you drift off into your own world, and yet filmmaking or TV making is so, so collaborative. Couldn't get
second
anything more collaborative.
By second.
Yeah. So to be an effective screenwriter, you kind of have to have the ability to be both.
How do you find that, Rolf?
I don't find the writing process so solitary, because I'm so with my characters. It's like they're not so much that they're real, but I'm constantly in dialogue with them, and there's constantly sort of a rich social life that I have by myself. Mm. I don't suffer from that sort of situation, I think. I love the writing process, but really to do it all, you know, produce as well and direct and everything else, that's for me the best, because it's such a varied 18 months that for it to be called work is almost, you know, it's unfair, really. It's
just what you're living with.
Yeah, it's great. It's wonderful.
That King is Dead, you said, it was sort of a moment of lightness and relief. What have you subsequently gone dark again? What's your...
Not dark, but dark and light. I've written another thing that I'm not sure whether it's a tragic comedy or a comic tragedy, but it's one of the two. Where it actually goes, we'll see if it happens.
The intersections are great. I very much like this idea of bridging genre. There is a sort of a tendency, isn't there, Michael Lucas, in sort of modern entertainment to be very prescriptive and sort of genre-tied.
Yeah, but I think with some of the most popular pieces of Australian film and TV, especially of recent years, I mean, Summer Heights High is hilarious, and then within a second, deeply tragic. And I think that's been a trait of a lot of the most memorable Australian works. And I mean, on Offspring as well, we slide between really broad slapstick to pretty gut-wrenching, the worst kind of tragedy you could imagine. And I think Australian audiences seem to embrace it.
But it's something everybody embraces in their lives. I mean, that's not a big jump. Well, why would entertainment seek to simplify the experience?
Exactly. I think it's actually a truer expression of the way life is, constantly sliding from the ridiculous to the tragic.
Rolf Dahir, what happens to your old characters after inhabiting your head for 18 months? Where do they go?
Well, they change as you make the film and as you cast them. They're suddenly...
And after the film?
And then after the film, they move cities, really. And that's I think, really what happens, because you might... 10 years later, you see the film again, and you go, oh, look at that. But the actors are really a part embodiment of the characters by then, and they tend to want to come back, and they tend to stay friends, or at least good acquaintances at worst. They do remind you, but when you see the film again 10 years later, that's when, you know, you visit the city they've moved to.
There's nothing that you've created that you'd rather have left behind and closed the door on?
No, I sort of love
for good and ill.
Each one of them, yeah.
Michael, anything does that resonate in your experience of characters?
Yeah, certainly I do find it hard to say goodbye at times, and I really remember the last pass that I wrote of the script right before we went into production, and I realised, you know, as I was sitting there tapping away, this is the last time it's just going to be me and these characters. And I did go out and get some wine and sit there and drink it. I felt really nostalgic about it. And then,
sweet.
Yeah, even now, it's getting towards the last of the time that I'm going to spend with the actors as the film gets released, and I no longer have excuses to hang out with them for long periods of time. And again, that's making me really...
After a period of such creative intensity.
Yeah, and I find myself thinking, maybe I could do a TV series.
This is why people do sequels, you see.
Yeah.
Get the gang back together. In the drawing room tonight, we've been chatting with Rolf Dahir and Michael Lucas. Two new films opening tonight around the country. Rolf's The King is Dead and Michael's Not Suitable for Children. Thank you both very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan.